Yeah. It's Rational Response Squad. About to hit you in your motherfucking face. It's like they keep telling lies, why they keep telling lies? Jesus never existed and he's ripping off you guys. You'll read the Jesus puzzle and the faith, the incredible shrieking son of man. Who testaments a scam like that phony ass Koran. Can't they chew around like bands, like that whack ass Benny Hinn, Billy Graham, Pope Finn. They some sick and twisted men, why they lying to the people, trying to turn them all to sheep. The Bible's simply cruel, all of Nietzsche's shit is deep. Put a rational response, we critique the evidence. In 2006, religion has no relevance. Just a sick and twisted dance, trying to take the pain from death. Osama selling virgins, what the fuck do Christians get? An ascetic came to earth just to make you feel like shit. Well, you can't die for me, no, you can't die for me. You'll bury like a witch, go ahead and cry for me. Cry for me. Yo. And this goes out to Rook Sapien, Scientific Mike. Nothing but free thoughts transmitting through the night. Evolution is the record for the evidence we fight. Richard Dawkins, Robert Price, trying to set the record right. On the mic, flow precise, anti-gospel, anti-Christ, anti-ad-culture twice. Fuck right-wingers, archetypes. Just a bunch of wicked lies, selling war, selling spies. School of liberties in disguise, while they checking out our lives. While they can download this track, Patriots Invasion app. We're just trying to fight back, rational and that's a fact. Why they keep telling lies when religion's a disguise? To take the pain from death and to govern all the people. I'm asking you the questions in the Inquisition sequel. Most rational people look beyond the good and evil. Most rational people, we look beyond the good and evil. My name is Proclaim once again. Chilling out. The Rational Responders, Mike Rook and Sapien, doing big things. Be on the lookout for the upcoming album, Question Everything. You can find it at ProcleanCreations.com. Once again, this is the Rational Response Squad, bringing it to you live and direct.
Join us right now in the chat room at www.rationalresponders.com. If you are listening to our live stream, join us in the chat room at www.rationalresponders.com.
This is Ray Comfort, and you're listening to the Rational Response Squad.
Welcome to another episode of the Rational Response Squad, talking about Jesus is a myth. I am Brian Sapient.
I am Rook Hawkins.
I am Yellow Number 5.
I am Richard Carrier.
And we are
the Rational Response Squad.
We are broadcasting live in the Stickham Room today, again, for another episode of the Rational Response Squad. As I said in previous episodes, chuck us out in the Stickham Room from now on when we do our 14, 15-hour recording sessions on Saturdays, when the guys get together and record a bunch of shows for future air on the many different radio stations that play us. FreeThoughtMedia.com, Revere Radio Network, Lunk Radio. We are everywhere.
Atheist Network.
You can get us. AtheistNetwork.com. That's right. Thank you. Thank you, Mike. Forgot the most important one, the originator of all of this, AtheistNetwork.com. Before we get started, I can't forget also about our sponsors, EvolveFish.com and DoubleDough.com. EvolveFish.com, of course, is the home of the Evolve Fish, where you can find the latest and greatest in atheist products, including our special guest, Richard Carrier's book called Sense and Goodness Without God, A Defense of Metaphysical Naturalism. There's also another book at EvolveFish.com by Robert Price and The Empty Tomb.
Yes.
The Empty Tomb. So
Price and Louder are the editors.
Price and Louder. And you worked on that book as well, correct?
I have three chapters in it, yes.
Three chapters in that book. So today's topic is the story of Jesus. And, of course, we all know that Jesus existed, right, Richard?
No.
Do we?
We don't know that.
No, we don't know that.
And so, I mean, seriously, right to the point. Get it out of the way right now. Do you think a historical Jesus existed?
I think it's improbable.
It's improbable. Okay, so why do so many people believe that a historical Jesus existed?
Well, they're operating on sound reasoning based on the information they have. I mean, basically, you should assume a historical person was historical unless you have a sufficient reason to doubt it. But in order to get to the position where you've gotten enough evidence to go, oh, you know what? Maybe there wasn't a Jesus. You need to do a lot of research and a lot of study, and And of course, there's a lot of really bad work out there too that you have to wade through and ignore, or get through, get to the true and correct facts of the issue. So it's a very difficult thing. Even experts in the field aren't looking at the same literature and the same evidence, the same facts. So it's a situation where we need to start spreading the information more formally, more accurately, more correctly through the academic community, and then to start build a consensus.
And what do you think is the biggest reason to doubt the Jesus existed story?
Yeah, there is no one thing. There's no one thing you say, that settles the issue. In fact, if there were like 10 little things, that wouldn't even be 10 reasons to be suspicious. That wouldn't be enough to doubt. You could say, well, okay, there's some room for doubt, but still it's probably he existed in some sense, in the limited sense of a guy who claimed to be Jesus and was crucified by Pontius Pilate, and then all this other stuff was made up about him, for example. Even that you should assume, but it's when you start accumulating facts, you get to like 100 suspicious details, 200 suspicious details, it
right.
starts to, you know, it breaks the camel's back eventually.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. We've got some questions submitted by the audience today on this issue, and we're going to jump around, but, you know, most importantly, we will be on this Jesus is a Myth topic all day. Before we do that, though, we're going to take a brief commercial break, and we'll be right back with Richard Carrier and the Rational Response Squad.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney. In my new play, Letting Go of God, I come out clearly as an atheist, absolutely committed to keeping church and state separate. Won't you join me and the Freedom From Religion Foundation in waking up America to the growing dangers of theocracy? Phone 1-800-335-4021, that's 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. That's ffrf.org.
In the Bible, it tells us in Mark 3:29 that whoever may blaspheme against the Holy Spirit never has forgiveness, but is guilty of an eternal sin. In other words, those who deny the Holy Spirit's existence can never get to heaven. They can never be forgiven. And with that said, I'm Brian Sapient, and I deny the existence of the Holy Spirit.
I'm Rick Hawkins, and through my study of the Bible, there's no way that the Holy Spirit could even possibly exist. It was a forgery. Therefore, I deny the Holy Spirit.
I'm Yeller number 5, and I deny the Virgin Mother raping Holy Spirit.
I'm Kelly M78, and I deny the Holy Spirit.
I'm Richard Carrier, and I deny the Holy Spirit because it's, well, patently ridiculous.
There's no point trying to save us, folks. You're listening to the Rational Response Squad.
The Rational Response Squad has taught me that I don't have to say under God in school when I pledge to the flag. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. The Rational Response Squad can be found at www.rationalresponders.com. Check them out today.
Join us right now in the chat room at www.rationalresponders.com. If you aren't listening to our live stream, join us in the chat room at www.rationalresponders.com.
And we are back with Richard Carrier and the Rational Response Squad talking about Jesus is a Myth. Mike, you've got some audience-submitted questions there. What do we got here?
Right. Would you like to start with Paul?
Yeah, whatever you like to do, yeah.
Okay. This question comes from a philosopher. He has a question concerning Paul, the Apostle Paul. He says here, there are a handful of passages in Paul that seem to point to Paul's belief in an earthly Jesus. Can you comment on the following passages from a mythicist perspective? He goes on to list several passages here.
Yeah.
I'll pick two or three of them. In Galatians 1:19, Paul says, but I saw none of the other apostles except James and the Lord's brother. Also in 1 Corinthians 9:5, he says, do we not have the right to take along a believing wife as do other apostles and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas? How does a mythical being have earthly brothers, you know, one of whom Paul met?
Yeah, those go together, so we can
right.
talk about those first.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, those are very vague. No one's called the brother of Jesus.
Right.
Why not?
Exactly.
Why is it the brother of the Lord?
It's very
right.
grammatically incorrect.
He's not biologically the Lord, so you actually can't even literally be the brother of the Lord. That's, like, semantically impossible. You could only be the brother of Jesus, the fleshly body.
Right.
I think it's a title. Yes. It's similar to when you go up in the ranks in the Masons, you get these weird, right. freaky titles like, you know, Brother of the Sphinx and, you know, all these strange things. I think it's like that. It's a particular status in the church.
Like in a fraternal sense. Like a
fraternity. Like a very, and of course, they already have the model in there where they're calling each other brothers of the Lord all the time. Yeah, I mean, he says that we're adopted by God when we become baptized, so we're all brothers of the Lord. I mean, literally, in a legal, you know, sense and in the philosophical sense. So they already have the concept of just ordinary people being the brother of God, in a sense, the brother of the Son of God, if you want to call it that. Mm. And so I think there was a more formal title of someone who'd reached a certain level in the initiations in the church, and they were called brothers of the Lord. Now, that basically balances it. So now we have two hypotheses as to where these terms came in, and you couldn't really decide between the two on that alone. And I think it's when you look at all the other evidence that you start to say, well, then I think the mythic explanation is starting to look more probable. But one of the examples is, for example, Luke Acts. Luke Acts claims to be and actually is the only set of books in the New Testament that actually follows any sort of historiographical genre. I mean, he's actually portraying himself as writing history. He follows certain genre markers of history and claims to have followed everything accurately from the beginning and so on. And yet he has absolutely no knowledge of James being the brother of Jesus.
Right.
There was only two prominent Jameses in his church, the church that he described. Neither of them are brothers of Jesus. He's very specific about this. In Acts 1, he even mentions the other two Jameses as brothers of these other guys and sons of these other guys. And then he says, and there were the brothers of Jesus as well. So he actually explicitly says that there are these brothers of Jesus, and he has no idea that James is one of them.
Exactly.
There are little pieces of evidence like that, that when you start stacking it up, it starts to look like, you know, what Paul's saying is not a brother of a physical person named Jesus. He's brother of the Lord as a term, title, in essence.
Okay. That certainly makes sense. He goes on to say, you know, more about familial relationships here. In Romans 1:3, concerning his son, who was descended from David according to the flesh, and he gives another similar passage that also would be, the Davidic line of descent.
Yeah.
He asks, how is a mythical being descended from David?
Yeah, it's an allegory.
Right.
I mean, he's very explicit about this with the mother in Galatians 4, where he says, you know, Jesus was born of a mother, and then he immediately goes on to talk about these two women that are merely allegorical women, and that we're children of these women. We, the Christians and the Jews, are children of these women in a metaphorical sense, not a biological sense. So I think the terminology, of course, all this comes from Scripture, so they're reinterpreting Scripture. That said, the Messiah had to be of the seed of David. Of course, God could make any celestial being out of any seed he wanted, because he's God, basically. So I think that's what he's referring to, is it's a metaphorical concept.
It's an archetypal state.
What's that?
It's an archetypal state, almost.
Like, yeah, I suppose you could say that.
It was through the resurrection that Jesus became the Son of God and thus restored man's true spiritual archetypal state, but in a spiritual sense.
Yeah, yeah, that's a little obscure, I think, but obscure way to put it. Yes, and it's interesting though that Paul only talks in this sort of formalistic, very inspecific term. You know, from the seed of David. He never says, born to the womb of Mary, for example, or he doesn't give any specific details of when he was born. I mean, he says son of the seed of David, but he never says son of Joseph. He never names the father of Jesus. You know, so it's always this formulaic sort of scriptural phrase that doesn't actually have any reference to the father of Jesus. I mean, David wasn't the father of Jesus, unless in a sort of spiritual metaphorical sense, that's exactly what God did, is took a seed from David and made this Jesus figure, which of course would not have happened on earth.
Right.
So, the point being is that there are two ways to interpret that, and you could interpret it in a historicist sense, you could interpret it in a mythicist sense, but when you analyze all the evidence, the historicist sense starts to look less believable.
Okay. The Davidic descent and the virgin birth, like for me, those were always big issues with me. Not so much from a Jesus myth point of view, but just from a biblical contradiction point of view. That was one that even as a kid when I read it, I'm like, this doesn't make any freaking sense. You know, he can't be descended from Joseph through David and have a virgin birth at the same
time.
That's
right. That's right.
You know, like, okay, is he God's son or is he Joseph's?
Yeah,
you know,
and the Christian response is, well, legally he was. But
right,
the problem
right.
is Paul didn't say legally. He says
exactly,
from
right.
the seed of David. So he means the some semen, supposedly, exited a Davidic ancestor and entered a womb and impregnated a woman. Unless, of course, you interpret it metaphorically. And that's the whole problem.
We'll take a couple more from philosophers here. He's got a whole list, but I don't want to spend all day on Paul.
You can immediately strike away all the books that we know are forgeries that are not of questionable Pauline
right.
authorship. Well, let's just read the books that he lists.
He's got Romans, he's got Corinthians, Thessalonians, Galatians.
Okay,
those are all good.
Those are all good. Yeah.
Okay. We'll take another example here. He has, in 1 Corinthians 11:23 to 25, recounts the Lord's Supper. How does a mythical being dine with human host?
That's interesting, especially because he immediately says, I'm going to tell you what the Lord told me or what I received from the Lord.
Right.
It's not
what
someone told him. It's right. not a story that was passed down. This is what he received by direct revelation from God. And when you read it in that sense, what he's describing is a vision of Jesus in heaven communicating this to his entire church. Because if you notice, when he describes the Lord's Supper, he doesn't describe a historical setting. He doesn't mention the disciples being there. He doesn't mention any particular people being there or any particular events happening. It's Jesus communicating this sort of general spiritual fact about the church, about blood and flesh, the wine and bread. And if you look at it, it's clearly it's Jesus speaking to the whole church in a
right.
vision. Now, of course, you could try to say that he stylized it that way and he was describing a real event and didn't want to cite his historical sources or, you know, you could come up with some sort of ad hoc hypothesis to make this historical. And if there wasn't all this other evidence that added up and accumulated against it, that might even be believable. But I think when you look at the total range of evidence, the mythicist explanation of this passage makes a lot more sense.
Right.
Okay. Well, we covered, I think, Paul pretty in depth there. There's an additional question related to Paul. This comes from Valmerde. He says, do you believe that Paul held that Jesus existed on earth as a human? If he didn't, how could he say that Jesus, after the resurrection, appeared to the 12? Considering the most common Christian ideas had the death of Judas before the resurrection, does this imply that Judas was thought as alive by Jesus? And much more importantly, Jesus still considered Judas an apostle? Would this give validity to the Gospel of Judas and its ideas about Judas? Or does 12 refer to something else entirely, such as the 12 patriarchs?
Right. Well, there are many mystical connotations of the number 12. That's true. I strongly suspect, I'm not entirely convinced of this yet, but the more I look at it, the more I suspect that this particular passage in 1 Corinthians has been messed with by later scribes. I point out in particular how I think they've doctored the 500 passage, the passage of the appeared to more than 500. I discuss that in one of my chapters in The Empty Tomb. But these others are also, for example, I don't think Paul ever refers to disciples. He never uses the word disciples anywhere else, I don't think. And calling it the 12 doesn't make any sense either, because it completely contradicts the gospel narrative in that sense that Judas was supposed to not be there, and it was only after Jesus made his appearances that they elected another member of the 12. And Paul never otherwise refers to the 12. So this is a completely idiosyncratic passage in Paul, in all of Paul's letters. That makes it a little bit suspect, and especially because there are obvious polemical reasons for a scribe to interpolate this passage. I suspect that what Paul originally wrote started with Cephas, and then mentioned the Pentecost appearance, and then mentioned his appearance. It was just three, following the model of the pattern of the number three that he does throughout the rest of the chapter. And I think these other passages, the reference to James and the reference to the 12, are interpolated. And for one of the examples is that Jesus appears to the 12, Then he appears to more than 500 brethren, and then he appears to James and the apostles.
Right.
Well, wait a minute. If he appeared to 500 brethren, surely, you know, James wasn't left out of that number, right? So why would there be another appearance to James and the apostles, and why would it come after an appearance to all the members of the church? There are a lot of questions here that it just doesn't make a whole lot of logical sense, and it's hard to imagine Paul, who was not a stupid man, would be writing these passages. These look like things that have been doctored in. And of course, if you want to hear more about the argument for the possibility of interpolation here, Robert Price makes a much more forceful argument for excluding the whole section. I don't go as far as he does, but I think he's right to be suspicious, and he writes a lot of other reasons to be suspicious and why certain arguments against the interpolation hypothesis don't hold as much weight as people think. And that's in one of the chapters in The Empty Tomb by Robert Price.
This is related to the Jewish Supreme Council that, you know, met on Passover.
Oh, wait, actually, they were talking about the Gospel of Judas.
Yes.
The answer to that question is no. no, the Gospel of Judas is total fiction. Of course, I think so are the Gospels. But anyway,
but it's a much later Gospel.
It is a much later Gospel. Scenario being described is far more sophisticated than anything we see in the earlier Gospels. And clearly is meant to convey a particular spiritual point, which is an example of writing and fabricating a gospel that tells a seemingly historical narrative to make a religious point. Not because it actually happened, but because in order to convey their spiritual message, they caged it into this story, this historical story, to represent the things they wanted to convey. And if they were willing to do it, there's absolutely no reason to assume that the canonical gospel writers were above doing this too.
Right.
But it makes good fodder for the History Channel.
Yes, a 4th century gospel.
I actually saw evidence for the most astonishing thing that my friend David Fitzgerald and I. David Fitzgerald is writing a book on the historicity of Jesus as well, and he's a very funny man. And we were watching Biography Channel, waiting for something else, and there was a Biography Channel where they had a murder. It was the murder mystery of Cain and Abel, and the whole thing was done. I mean, literally. There was no doubt at all about the existence of Cain and Abel. They were talking about, like, this was an actual historical event and that we should try and analyze and study, like, what was the motive? What weapon did he use? You know, I mean, really, like, deadly serious. And we're like, are you kidding me? I mean, I'd expect this, like, on the 700 Club or something, but not on the Biography Channel.
Yeah, it's
I can't remember if it was Biography or History Channel, but I think it was Biography Channel. And that it really blew us away. We were just amazed.
That's ridiculous.
Valmorday goes on to ask, what do you think about the idea that the Jewish Supreme Council would not meet on Passover Eve to judge Jesus, thus making it historically flawed?
Isn't it against the law?
It's illegal. It's illegal in more than one sense, actually. The Mishnah, not even the Talmud, the Mishnah, which is the earliest oral law we have, and it clearly dates back to Jesus, is very explicit that a murder trial has to take place over 2 days, and those 2 days cannot be interrupted by a festival, because they have to be consecutive. And it's very specific as to why. If you interrupt it with a holy day, you might forget things that went on in the first day of the trial. So they're very explicit, and they say if it's going to be split up, you have to wait until after the holiday.
Right.
And they're very specific about this, and it is very specific where there has to be 1 day of trial, and then there has to be renewed deliberations the next day. So it has to be a 2-day trial for all capital crimes.
Right.
And clearly we're not looking at a 2-day trial in the Gospels.
It's like five minutes.
They've doctored the whole story to fit their sort of soteriological message.
Right.
Now that in itself, that's important to distinguish. That in itself is not an argument against the historicity of Jesus, because there could have actually been a genuine trial that was conducted correctly that just didn't fit the chronology that the Christians wanted, and then it just doctored the chronology and the story and compressed events and stuff to make it fit their particular vision of their particular message. So it's important to distinguish, what actually is an argument for ahistoricity versus what is an argument for the Gospels
validity,
doctoring the story in a sense, in order to make a message.
The next questions are in relation to Earl Doherty's Jesus myth hypothesis. Richard Spencer asks here, you stated in your review of the Jesus puzzle that after doing your own research, you found even more evidence than Doherty presented in support of the mythicist position. Could you please share some of this evidence, and could you give us references for further reading on the subject that you think would be most helpful? Also, do you think a book on this subject or multiple books, as you stated, might be required, are in the future for you? And, of course, Weimer follows up, what is your position on the Jesus myth hypothesis espoused by Doherty?
Yeah. Well, Doherty and I mean, we're friendly, we communicate. We have a lot of disagreements about specific details of his theory of the origin of Christianity. But I think he's gotten closer to the correct account than any other mythicist, hypothesizer, if you say. So I think his book is worth reading. You know, you need to check his claims and not simply believe everything he says hook, line, and sinker, because he does sometimes confuse hypotheses with facts, or at least the way he words it. So read it with care, but, it is a valuable book. And there's nothing that's blatantly ridiculous or false in it. I mean, there might be errors or bad judgments and things, but there's nothing like a Kersey Graves kind of boo-boo.
Huh.
And so, yeah, his book is definitely worth reading, and worth interacting with and challenging and so forth. But with regard to, recommendations, I don't have any yet. There is no ideal collection of readings for this subject, especially because everything that's out there is of mixed quality right now. And I do plan on writing a book, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to try and get a series of papers through peer review at academic journals first, because I think this is a theory that shouldn't be sold under the radar. We should be approaching the academic community and asking them to judge it by their professional objective standards. And so that's what I'm going to do. Even if it ends up being refuted, that's fine. But it has to, I mean, it needs now to go into that arena, and I'm going to package it that way over the next few years. Eventually then I'll have enough papers to expand into a book, and then I'll publish. And then that will be the book I would recommend. But in the meantime, I mean, I take the professional standards of my field very seriously, so I don't expect people to believe, that Jesus didn't exist. I don't think it's right to go beating people over the head with this, because they're not in an epistemic situation to agree with you, and you shouldn't expect them to agree with you until they've looked over all of the evidence, and it's not easy to do, because it's tons of evidence, it's very complicated to analyze it. And especially the academic community, and that's what we need to do, is package it to the academic community, and they will either be able to refute it, which will be fine, then we'll at least have the question settled, or they will start to agree, and then we'll actually have a consensus of scholarship among the experts. And that's the direction we need to take this, and that's where I plan to take it.
That goes to the heart of what we're all about here at the Rational Response Squad. You know, we don't want anybody to blindly trust anything we say here, and do your own research with whatever you hear on the show. Because if you don't, then you're doing what we are very much against, which is the idea of blind faith. So, of course, you know, we bring some evidence to the table to back our claim, so you can trust us a little bit, but
cross-reference
us.
Trusting us wouldn't be blind faith, because I think we are usually right.
Hey, we're usually right.
We're close. I mean, we always make at least a cogent argument.
In the Stickham chat room right now, Bahana asks, Richard, which letters of Paul do you think are authentic?
What are the top seven, Rook?
They are Romans, Hebrews, 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, Galatians, 1 Thessalonians, and I'm sorry, Hebrews. Why did I say Hebrews 4?
Yeah,
well, Hebrews is 2, yes.
Hebrews shouldn't be in there, but anyway.
Yeah, it's Philippians and Philemon, if I'm correct.
Yeah, that sounds right.
And then the rest of them are considered city graphs, or
they're considered either forged or so badly messed with as to not not be definite examples of what Paul actually meant to write. Yeah, the pastorals, for example, are generally rejected as non-Pauline.
I don't know why I said Hebrews. I think I was just looking at a Hebrew passage when I said
that. No, yeah, Hebrews was not written by Paul.
No.
It could well have been written by someone of Paul's generation.
Right.
Well, it's dated and it doesn't say anything that I think Paul would disagree with, but it wasn't by Paul's hand.
Right.
And
it's very Gnostic and esoteric in and of itself, so. But it's not Paul. You're right.
But this is a question that you can answer yourself by going to the library and checking the multi-volume set of the New Interpreter's Bible, for example. The New Interpreter's Bible is multiple volumes, and they have introductory chapters for every book of the Bible where they update you on the scholarship, the state of scholarship, and you can immediately read there to see how firmly scholars have ruled against a certain book as being authentic and sometimes why. So the New Interpreter's Bible is, it's not affordable. It's not something you can, unless you're ridiculously rich and have a huge bookshelf that you can stack this thing. I don't know how many volumes. It's like 10 or 12 volumes, but
wow.
a good library should have one.
Of course, and, a friend of the show is Dennis McKinsey, who wrote Biblical Inerrancy.
Yeah, he's a good friend of mine, too.
Rook's one of his main men, so check out that book as well.
Yeah, I don't know how much he talks about authenticity of the letters, though.
He uses a lot of Remsburg's arguments in his discussions, which, I mean, a little bit outdated.
Yeah.
But,
I would want to direct your readers to the most up-to-date. And
right.
There is actually the new Interpreter's Bible it's very up-to-date. I mean, fairly up-to-date. And it does have good scholarly chapters on each book, introducing each book.
Right.
And another place to look is Erdmann's Dictionary of the Bible. Erdmann's is sometimes a little pro-Christian, but generally it represents the honest, objective state of particular books. For example, their entry on Isaiah gives you an accurate picture of the sections of Isaiah that are believed to be interpolated and non-authentic and so forth. And it gives you further readings, bibliography at the end. So Erdmann's Dictionary of the Bible, which is affordable, and I highly recommend everyone get a copy if you're interested in biblical studies. It's the sort of thing you think you're going to be looking something up on the Bible every week. You should have Erdmann's. There's no doubt. After that, as I have recommended, which is the Oxford Dictionary of the Christian Church, which is a lot more expensive, but it's still
very expensive.
Yeah. It's a lot less expensive than the New Interpreter's Bible, but it is an authoritative dictionary on early Christian history, and it actually goes up into early medieval and later medieval Christian history as well. But that's also a good reference book for these things.
This might be sort of a leading question. Samuel Thomas Poling asks, what is the strongest historical evidence that Jesus rose from the grave or even existed that you've heard? And what, in your opinion, makes that inconclusive?
The strongest.
Yeah. So if
yeah.
If they had, the strongest historical case you've heard made? You know, if it's possibly maybe in a someone who's written a book that you think gives a fairly strong argument.
Oh, yeah. Well, like, what would be the best book to read? The problem is a lot of the books really, there's so much dishonesty and misrepresentation in them that I can't even recommend them.
I have something on this. If you can comment on it, mm-hmm. too. I've heard the argument of, people questioning, the names, some of the names of the apostles in the gospel accounts and saying that there's no way anyone would have made these up because they're just so odd. Like, Cephas or something similar to that. It's,
Cephas, you mean?
Cephas, yeah. That's right. It's like, almost like the name Rocky. You know, in English, it's so odd of a name that there's no way that, you know, if these had to be real people because of, just how far off the name, some of the names were.
That kind of gets off track because the historicity of Cephas isn't entirely in doubt. So,
right.
I mean, Paul refers to him as an actual person.
Right.
And nicknames like that are not uncommon. I mean, there's, for example, there's Porcius Festus, who's the governor of,
It's like Biggest Dickus.
Yeah. he was one of the Roman magistrates. He's mentioned in Acts and is probably a real person, and that's a real Roman name, but it means Happy the Pig. It's like, that's a weird name, man. That's a weird name, but it's an actual Roman name.
Wow.
So, you know. So anyway, so no, that gets off track.
Honestly, I can't think of any other argument that would even
For the resurrection. Let's stick with the resurrection
because
that was the first question. The best, which it's still not sufficient, but the best argument is the reference to the appearance to the 500. I would think that's the best piece of evidence they have for the resurrection of Jesus. Basically because it's early and it's difficult to explain without an actual appearance. I don't think it's that difficult to explain, but it is, I think it is the most challenging piece of evidence. And so, and therefore is the most important one to address and interpret in a sense. That's what I would say about the resurrection. About historicity, I would say just in general, the sort of, barrage collection of passages in Paul that can be interpreted as references to a historical Jesus collectively. Not any one of them is really all that strong, but collectively, that would be the best case they could make. I don't think it's a sufficient case. It would be a sufficient case had we not had all this other evidence that actually makes the mythicist explanation more likely. But that is the best argument they have, is the stuff they can drag out of Paul. Unfortunately, it's also the best argument we have for mythicism, is that there's so little that you can drag out of Paul, and it's so ambiguous.
Right.
I draw the analogy I can't remember if I've done this in print yet, but Tacitus and Pliny were good buddies, basically. They wrote to each other quite a lot, and we have a bunch of their letters exchanged. And Tacitus was writing a history, the story of, the history of Rome, and he was covering the period where Vesuvius erupted. And Pliny the Younger's uncle died trying to rescue people. Because when the volcano went off, he got into a ship, because he was a naval commander at the time, and wanted to investigate for scientific reasons, and then realized that there was people that were dying and needed rescuing, so he tried to rescue them, and he was overcome by volcanic fumes and died. And apparently, and some people obviously survived of his crew, because they were able to tell the story.
Right.
And so Tacitus wanted to know, well, hey, this is very interesting, this is an amazing event, so tell me, I want to know more details about it. And so Pliny goes and tells the whole story in meticulous detail, because Pliny the Younger was there. I mean, he was actually spoke with his father, and his father actually asked, do you want to come with? And he says, no, I don't want to. But it was very, this kind of personal, firsthand eyewitness case, and Pliny was able to describe the cloud of the volcano as it appeared in scientific detail, because he saw it, and then it got reports from the crew as to what happened to his uncle. So here we have this for Pliny the Elder, this amazing event, this heroic act. Why don't we have anything like this for Jesus? I mean, why?
Right.
And why don't we have this curiosity? I mean, Tacitus wanted to hear this story. Why wouldn't? I mean, if Paul has, let's say, Paul had 500 Christians throughout the world, at least one of them would be curious and go, hey, tell me the story. I'm very interested. What, like, give me some more details about, what actually happened.
Right.
And you'd have stories where you'd have Paul or Peter or whoever was literate. I'm sure someone had to be literate in the entourage of Jesus, if he existed, would be writing these personal reminiscences.
Oh, did you know the Gospels were all first-hand accounts?
Yeah, that's a good example, because if you compare the Gospels with this letter from Pliny,
exactly,
they're worlds apart in narrative style and in content and everything. It's incredible that, the heroic act of Pliny the Elder is better documented than the most heroic act supposedly in the history of the universe.
Right.
Exactly. But even if you say that that Jesus was just an ordinary historical person and not the Son of God and all that, surely there had to be more curiosity, and surely there had to be more letters being written about personal reminiscences and so forth. And it's just not there. I mean, you have to really try hard to try and find these ambiguous phrases in Paul to try and bootstrap an argument for historicity.
Right.
And I think the fact that you have to do that in itself is an argument against historicity.
Right.
Not a decisive argument, but it's another one to add to the stack that breaks the camel's back.
Right. Well, as kind of a follow-up to that, one of the arguments I constantly get from people is, you mentioned Pliny and Tacitus there. There's also, the Talmud and Josephus.
Talking about the references to Christ.
Right, extra biblical mentions of Jesus, or, Josephus also mentions James, brother of Jesus. And things along those lines. Why are such sources not convincing? Just in general.
There are many things you could say against a lot of those things that are problematic. Each one has its own problems. The general broader problem is they were all written after 95 AD.
None of them were contemporary.
They were all written after historicity was already being claimed by Christians.
Right.
So they're basically just reporting what Christians were saying, which doesn't really tell you what was actually going on in Paul's day.
Right, and half those accounts, most of them don't even talk about Jesus.
Tacitus
and Suetonius only talk about Christians, in a sense. And
that's right. Well, no. Tacitus talks about Christ.
Well,
I don't know if he uses the name Jesus, but he talks about Christ.
He says
they
who worshipped
talking about Pliny the Elder, Younger, I think.
Maybe I am.
Pliny the Younger mentions no Jesus. He only knows of this Christ as if a god.
Right, but doesn't...
Right.
Very vague.
But Tacitus is talking about the destruction of Rome, basically.
Right, yeah.
He's talking about the Christians who were blamed for it.
Yeah, right.
Who were being, pretty much, which I don't understand this, if Nero just had these gardens put in place, and he's going to burn Christians on the gardens that he just put for the people who were displaced by the fire. It doesn't make any sense to me, but I don't know
if he mentions gardens. They were looking for Tacitus is very general. They were looking for just any place they could stick these pyres and stuff.
Right,
so
right.
They had the, and it was mostly in the arena where these things were going on. But
right.
And with these ostentatious, you know, barbaric displays by Nero that Tacitus criticizes.
Right.
But no, in that Tacitus reports what the Christians believed. But of course, this is, you know,
117 AD.
He's just reporting what Christians told him, which in fact is probably what Christians told Pliny, because Tacitus was governing Bithynia when Pliny was governing. I'm sorry, Tacitus was governing Galatia when Pliny was governing Pontus and Bithynia, and those are right next to each other. They were governing at the same time. That's when Pliny interrogated the Christians at the same time. And you know, two best friends who are governing neighboring provinces are communicating all the damn time.
Right.
So Tacitus probably got his information from Pliny the Younger, who got his information from these Christians. And Pliny's very explicit. He says he knows nothing about Christians. He's never heard anything about Christians. He doesn't even know what laws pertain to Christians. He doesn't know anything about Christians. And he only finds out once he interrogates these Christians in this particular one instance.
Right.
So that's the first he's ever heard of this stuff. And if that's the first Pliny, and Pliny had a lot of major offices in Rome, and he was more plugged in than Tacitus.
And that's why
if he didn't know, Tacitus sure as hell didn't know. So the only way Tacitus probably found out is through his friend Pliny, which means he got all his information from this Christian deaconess,
in
110 AD. So
I mean, I've heard stories about forgery issues in Pliny, though, and that particular, just that one particular letter just has come across as unauthentic.
I doubt that.
Do you mind if I state the case and you can just destroy it? I mean, it's fine with me because even if it is authentic, it still has no reference or any sort of ground.
It's not useful
in
for
itself.
Historicity.
Probably utter silence of Pliny of the details of the reasoning behind the execution, the actual laws broken, the orders in which they were sentenced, and the utter failure by him to explain the reasoning behind the disturbances speak to it being written by a hand other than Pliny, and most likely written by Tertullian or somebody prior to him. And the second point is the fact that nowhere else in the entire collection of 121 letters do we see a single mention of Christians is defeating to the non-forgery issue. It's only seen in this one letter, and the letter itself appears only, it seems, for the Christians when they needed it, and not before.
Yeah, I don't think those are adequate arguments.
Okay.
First of all, Tertullian was a lawyer, probably knew more about Roman law than Pliny did. So if Tertullian had forged it, it would actually be better legally.
Right.
The content actually makes a lot of sense in the context of Roman law and jurisprudence and magisterial conduct. So there's nothing abnormal about that letter. The fact that, of course, that's the only one where Christians are mentioned is because clearly, as Pliny himself says, he knows nothing about Christians, and
right.
You know, they're virtually insignificant. And that shows that how rare they were and how their public profile was not high at all, even at this point.
Right.
So, I don't think those are adequate arguments against authenticity. The letter reads very much in Pliny's style. The manner of the way he approaches the issue is very much in the manner of Pliny's way of approaching issues. Trajan's response is completely in agreement with Trajan's entire jurisprudence attitude and so forth. It just rings of authenticity, and I don't see any particular reasons to argue against it. I mean, it gets rhetorical at points, but it gets rhetorical in exactly the way that you would expect a product of the Roman education system to get rhetorical. They always did that. So,
well, I suppose it's superstition. This entire belief structure is superstition in and of itself. I've heard people state that Pliny was a very compassionate person. So why would he be?
Well, the compassionate, you got to think compassionate in the terms that, magistrates of the British Empire were also very good Christians. but then, you know, you hear about some of the actual things they did, you know, kind of make you question, like, well, wait a minute. People can compartmentalize what they think is appropriate. And Pliny was certainly a child of his time. I mean, he saw the world in grades of social status, and that how you treat people varies depending on status.
Okay.
And you get that in the letter. I mean, the people who had Roman citizenship, he didn't touch. He sent to Rome for judgment. It was only the people of lower class, I think even slaves, I can't remember if he calls them slaves specifically, but definitely the lower class people, non-citizens, that he subjects to, well, he says torture. It's unclear exactly what that means. And that was common legal practice. It was assumed that no slave's testimony would be reliable unless it was under torture. So it was all slaves are always interrogated under torture. That doesn't necessarily mean, you know, nails were shoved into their fingernails it means they were strong-armed, definitely. and that was just common legal practice at the time, and Pliny wouldn't go against common legal practice. He would assume that's normal in the way things are done.
Once again, you are listening to the Rational Response Squad. Visit us, as always, when we broadcast our show on freethoughtmedia.com after the Infidel Guy in our chat room at rationalresponders.com. For those of you who don't know, we took a special picture yesterday, autographed it, Richard Carrier, myself, Rook, our newest squad member, Kelly, and my boy, Scientific Mike, as Proclaim says in the new theme song. We autographed that picture, and we sell that picture now at our website for $15. We have a little bet here in-house that it's going to take many years for us to sell all 15 pictures. So do me a favor. I think it's going to take 5 years. Rook thinks it's going to take 5 months. Prove Rook right, okay? Prove Rook right. So anyway, we are broadcasting in Stickham right now, live. And, of course, we've never done that before. We always keep our recording sessions very private because we edit our show and we screw up a lot. And it's pretty embarrassing, and we don't want anybody to hear it. But today you guys are getting in on that, and we think we might do this again in the future. And if you were a part of that and you like the broadcasts, maybe you'd send us a webcam, a nice webcam, so we don't have to deal with this old fuzzy quality. And one of the people in the Stickham room said here, Richard, Bahana says, how reliable do you think the letters of Clement are?
All of them unreliable except the first one.
All of them unreliable except the first one.
Yeah, all the other Clementine letters aren't from Clement. They might be from someone named Clement, but they're not from Clement Romanus, who wrote probably at the end of the first century.
The others are dated much later, aren't they?
Yeah, there's a lot of debates as to exactly when they should be dated, but there's sometime in the second century. The first letter of Clement, I think, probably actually was a letter written by a Christian leader towards the end of the first century.
Alright, now we actually have kind of a little controversy and a little screw up on my part that happened last month. We've been offering $666 for contemporary evidence of Jesus Christ for quite a while. We've never got any.
Yeah.
And I don't expect that we will. A good case can be made for the fact that Jesus Christ never existed. But I might have been wrong in a way that I've attacked it. And contemporary evidence and lack of contemporary evidence isn't really a very good way of looking at that issue. I put out, two challenges. One, let's get contemporary evidence for Jesus Christ. And two, prove to me that other people didn't have contemporary evidence for them. And you showed me that there were other people who we believe existed who didn't have contemporary evidence for them around that time.
Right.
Now, of course, Jesus, we have a gap of, what, about 40 years before we see any writings of him?
If you're excluding Paul, which, of course, you have to do by hypothesis, depending on how much you believe the hypothesis to explain the passages in Paul. If you think the Gospels are the first actual definitive historical placement of Jesus, yeah, we're talking 30, 40 years. Yeah.
30, 40 years. So, okay, so.
At a minimum, it could be more than
even
that.
More than that.
But, yeah.
But now, but back, okay.
It's no less.
Just so everybody knows, this challenge was brought up by myself only. I wrote this challenge and my other squad members saw it and they thought, we probably shouldn't have gone at it this way. Richard helped me right away, but I promised to talk about this, and put my foot in my mouth, so to speak. hey, I am not above being wrong. And, you know, the fact remains that the likelihood that Jesus existed is very low. The way that I went about my argument probably wasn't the greatest way to do it.
Yeah, it's the argument from silence is not a strong argument for ancient history because the survival of documents essentially is so poor. In order for an argument for silence to be logically valid, you have to have the reasonable expectation of a mention to survive. If you could have a lot of particular persons in antiquity where no documents survive from their particular lifetime in that particular area, or no documents survive from anyone who knew that person or whatever. And if you don't have any documents, there might have been documents, they didn't survive. So you can't argue that because we don't have any documents today that mention the person, that therefore the person didn't exist. That's an invalid argument there. It's only when you have a document that you would reasonably expect the person to be mentioned in that document and they aren't, even in the context of ancient history, then that becomes starts to become a valid argument. And I think, for example, the very strange silence which we were just talking about in the letters of Paul, where we don't have any personal reminiscences from Paul or from other supposed eyewitnesses of Jesus. I mean, if Jesus had 70 people in his entourage, one of them, at least one of them had to be literate. I mean, it just, unless he was literally just ignoring the entire literate class of the ancient world, which is improbable, I think. So, you know, we don't have any of those documents. We would expect to have those kinds of documents. But, and in the case of Jesus, there's a reason, because the church surely would have spent extra resources to preserve those documents.
Right.
But for someone else who the church didn't give a shit about, there's no reason to expect the church to preserve documents about them. For example, we know there were several pupils of Socrates who wrote about him. None of their work survived. I mean, we have Plato and Xenophon, for example. We have Aristotle. But there are a lot of others. But the Christians just weren't interested.
But don't we have contemporary references for Socrates?
Socrates, yeah. Socrates is well-established contemporary. But what I'm saying is that not all of the eyewitness accounts that were written were preserved, because the Christians weren't really interested.
I mean,
in
we
that.
Really have to search hard, though, to find some people that didn't have contemporary evidence for them, or more importantly, a 40-year gap.
Yeah, you have to look for people who weren't very important.
I almost stumped you on it. I mean, you were like, you know, trying to find them, and they're tough.
Yeah,
and especially when you say, okay, well, this is the Son of God.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? When you add that to the
that's
mix,
right,
it's
exactly.
Like, well, surely he would have known that people would exist today who want some better evidence.
That's right.
And
yeah.
So to...
Or would just be curious and want to know.
A 40-year gap,
that's very strange in the case of Jesus.
You know,
it wouldn't be strange in the case of some, you know, slave rebel person, you know, something like, or some person.
You can find anybody who's...
Right. You can find people who...
Small time. We're talking
exactly.
The Son of God.
Yeah.
I mean, God.
And, like, one of the points that, like, I've always made, and it's sort of a rhetorical point, but, you know, why don't we have any writings from Jesus himself? It just strikes me as... Just,
he's here on earth.
God doesn't know how to write.
It strikes me as funny.
God's illiterate.
Son of God.
Yeah.
Like, an illiterate Son of God. You know, Jesus could have just kept a diary and signed it God. And
it's so true.
And what I always thought was funny is that he's always pissing off the Sadducees and the Pharisees. Always doing it. Like, in every town he goes to, there's always some Sadducee or some Pharisee over there he's pissing off. You'd think that they would go back to the temple and write about, you know, how pissed off they were about this guy named Jesus who shut them up.
Well, there's also the case, there's Justice of Tiberius, who was a source used by Josephus. The Christians didn't preserve his works, but Justice of Tiberius wrote the history of Galilee during the first 30 years of the Christian era. I mean, a guy who lives in Galilee is writing the history of Galilee.
And
clearly never mentioned Jesus, because no one quotes him at all on this issue. You know, if Justice of Tiberius wrote the history of Galilee and included stories about Jesus, those quotes would be preserved all over the place.
He was walking
literature.
Around some of the same places that he would have seen Jesus.
That's right.
Had he been there.
Yeah. So that's an example. Even though we don't have Justice of Tiberius, we do have the reasonable expectation that if he mentioned Jesus, we would have those
writings
mentions
would
of
have
these.
Been preserved.
Right. So you can build an argument from silence simply because of the peculiar case of Jesus and the role of the church in preserving documents.
Right.
But there are a lot of other people in the ancient world that the Christian church didn't care as much about, and so they might not have preserved enough documentation. That's not considered a problem in ancient history.
But so. you still have somebody, you know, especially coming out of just before the turn of the second century, you still have some of the early Christians who are being, you know, told right to their face that this is all mythology, you're just making this shit up. You would have them start sitting there and quoting from these sources if they had them. They could have all been destroyed before the turn of the second century.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, the Christians were choosing what documents to preserve based on references to Jesus. That's probably the reason Josephus was preserved after the 4th century, was because someone interpolated this passage about Jesus in it, and because he covered the history of the period, that it became interesting to people. Of course, not a lot of manuscripts were preserved, but it was probably just that fact, the fact that a Christian doctored the text, is what inspired the church to engage the resources to keep preserving it.
Right, and some of these early fathers were using Josephus, like, time and time again to prove certain historical facts about the era, and not the TF was never used, ever.
Totally. Yeah, the point is also that, I mean, you've got that issue, but I think that in itself raises suspicion. What clinches it is when you look at the actual positive evidence for mythic development. And so you say, well, actually, the mythicist account of events makes more sense of the evidence than any historicist theory you can come up with. And so it's not just the argument from silence that's sufficient, although that does add to it, but you also need this sort of positive theoretical argument that basically your hypothesis tests better than alternatives.
Would you be willing to give a decent amount, like a decent summary of what you think the Methodist position is and the evidence for that position. Just like it can be as general as you'd like, but
yeah, no, you know, it's too much to say there, really.
Okay.
And that my first paper will state that I'm going to try and get through peer review, which will probably, I'll at least submit it mid 2007. Somewhere, I'm not sure where yet, but to an academic journal. That will state the general case without arguing that it's correct.
Okay.
And without going into every little minute detail. Because what my first paper is going to do is going to talk about, okay, this is the methodology we need to apply to solve this problem. This is the structure where the debate should surround, go around. And so I'll present the theory, I'll present the basic case and the model for proving it, and then challenge other scholars to attack the premises involved in there without asserting those premises are true yet. And that will generate more papers, and I'll have my own papers following that on more specific issues in the question. But that first paper, I think, will summarize the case, and,
okay.
And it's too premature now to
even disseminating
it. Yeah.
All right.
Once again, you were listening to the Rational Response Squad. Visit us at rationalresponders.com, and of course, myspace.com/rationalresponse. Check out our new t-shirts at cafepress.com/respondrational. Take a brief commercial break, and we will be right back with Richard Carrier.
Bowling for Columbine did it to the gun culture. Supersize Me did it to fast food. Now the God who wasn't there does it to religion. Holding modern Christianity up to a bright spotlight, this bold and often hilarious new film asks the questions few dare to ask. Your guide through the world of Christendom is former fundamentalist Brian Fleming, joined by such luminaries as Jesus Seminar fellow Robert Price, Professor Richard Dawkins, author Sam Harris, and historian Richard Carrier. See the movie the Los Angeles Times calls provocative, to put it mildly. Hold on to your faith. It's in for a bumpy ride. Purchase The God Who Wasn't There at www.rationalresponders.com.
Thanks for listening to the Rational Response Squad. This spot would be the perfect place for you to advertise your free thought-related business or organization. With rates as low as 2 cents per listener, we blow away the advertising competition. Furthermore, what better way to spread the word than to support an organization fighting to free humanity from the mind disease known as theism? Send a message to rationalresponsesquad@hotmail.com to learn about our rates. Again, that's rationalresponsesquad@hotmail.com. Your ad could be right here in next week's episode.
I am Luigi Gasoli, and I am a Swing Catholic Church in Italy. You are listening to Rational Response Squad.
And we're back from commercial. Thanks so much again, Richard, for joining us in the studio. We have another submitted question in the stick cam room. And I think I could actually help with this. Do you have any sources about the hero pattern? I can't seem to find anything on that. And I believe it's Lord Raglan's book, right?
Well,
right.
Dundas edited. Oh, no, it wasn't Dundas.
Alan Dundas.
Actually, I'll just do this right now. I'll bring up my bibliography. I'm actually going to discuss this in that one paper that I was talking about that I've already written. I'm just refining and checking it now.
While he's pulling up that information, folks, you can check out Richard Carrier's book, Sense and Goodness Without God, at evolvefish.com. Purchase the book from evolvefish.com by going to rationalresponders.com, bottom left-hand side of the page, click Atheist Goodies, and that supports us and Evolve Fish and Richard all at once. Wow, look at that, like Holy Trinity in action. So.
Okay, I found it. Robert Siegel et al., editors, In Quest of the Hero, published in 1990. That book, I think, brings together the Raglan and Rank material and Dundas's take on it. And that's a good place to start, I think, for that. Otherwise, there's not been a lot of really good stuff written on this. I'm going to write a little bit about it in the paper that I'll eventually publish on this subject.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with this, so forgive me if the question is too vague. But Dr. McGreg in the Stick Cam Room says that Justus Tiberius is disputed in Wikipedia. They are looking for citations.
We haven't preserved Justus of Tiberius.
Okay.
The Christians didn't preserve his writings.
But that,
I'm assuming that's the problem.
I think that's what he's trying to say.
Yeah, I mean, the argument from silence from Justus Tiberius is an argument by inference that that even though we don't have the text of justice to confirm that he didn't mention Jesus,
okay.
Had he mentioned Jesus, we have the reasonable expectation that we would have known about it.
Right.
It would have been quoted or something.
Excellent.
I have a question for you. I'm sure you get this an awful lot. Greek mythology influencing the Jesus myth.
That is actually, yeah.
That's always brought up. I mean, there are people who tell me that because no one particular god has all the traits that Jesus mythology is attributed to, that there's no way that he could have been just copied.
Right. Let me
can make it a little more general. This is one question that we did have that I forgot to add. What influence did gods such as Mithra, Horus, Isis, you know, Buddha, and other ancient deities, you know, Dionysus comes to mind.
Right.
Have on influence on early Christian writings and, you know, the Jesus myth in general.
Right. I discuss this particular issue.
You talk about a little bit in your Christianity to Improbable Would Be
True. I do.
True.
That's where it is. I'll re-go through that since I mentioned that in another show.
True Improbable Be False.
Yeah, it was, I have a sort of really huge, basically a book online, multiple chapters, refuting the argument that Christianity had attributes that would have made it impossible to succeed had it not been miraculous, or had Jesus not actually risen from the dead, based on a lot of social, cultural claims about the context of Jesus, or the context of Christianity. And this is called Was Christianity Too Improbable to Be False? And I have many chapters in there, and it's really a good primer on the origins of Christianity and the social historical context of that. So there's a lot of interesting stuff in there. And I do discuss the issue of when ancients were, you know, modeling gods and borrowing material from other gods, as there's a lot of, you know, incest going on among the different mythologies of the different gods. They were deliberately selecting things they wanted to select and deliberately leaving out things they wanted to leave out. And in fact, what they left out tells us something about what their message and what their values were. So it was,
right.
And what they changed. I mean, that would be something deliberate. They would take one parallel and then flip it upside down or change it. And that was deliberate because they knew the audience would know what story was being played on. And the way that they changed the story is communicating to their audience how their values differ from the values of the people they borrowed from.
Hmm.
And there's numerous examples of this outside of the context of Jesus studies. I give a speech on this subject, to various groups around the country. And one of the examples I give is how Virgil takes a boxing match that's depicted in Homer, and he completely changes the historical context. He changes which people are involved in the boxing match, but there's direct parallels. You can see that he's clearly taking the same boxing match, retelling the story, but he changes a few attributes of the story that show how Roman values, Roman heroic values, differ from Homeric heroic values. And so the way he took the story, he didn't borrow every element, he changed some elements, but that's exactly the point. I mean, he did
right.
that on purpose in order to make that point, that it's different. And so when Christianity absorbed ideas from other hero cults, other mythologies, other religious and philosophical ideas, what they left out is part of the point, and what they changed is part of the point. So it's invalid reasoning to say that they would just carbon copy some previous deity. That isn't what they were doing, and they weren't just like trying to, let's make a perfect amalgam god. Let's take all these gods and like try to make them all into one god. That's
right.
Not what they were doing. They were trying to sell a specific message about moral values, about their vision for society, and constructing it and telling the story in the way that the people, especially the literate people, understood best, which is in the form of narrative myth that made plays on cultural references and so forth. And one clear example of this is the whole Barabbas narrative. And I don't know if I've discussed this in public yet, other than in speeches. I've done it in public speeches. I don't know if I've mentioned it elsewhere, but Barabbas means son of the father. And so when you have this particular scenario where Pontius Pilate goes to the Jews and says, on every year on the festival, I release one prisoner for you. Who do you want? And they call for Barabbas, and so he gives them Barabbas. And then Jesus goes and gets executed, or instead of Jesus being picked to be released.
Right.
Well, this is totally 100% impossible for a Roman magistrate to do this, especially because Barabbas is described as
a
murderous
killer.
Rebel
right.
leader.
Right.
There's no way, especially Pontius Pilate, who was an evil son of a bitch who had no problem beating the shit out
Josephus
of mobs of
him.
Jews
oh.
in order to get his way.
Right.
There's no way he was going to release, a murderous rebel leader. I mean, the emperor would have had Pontius Pilate's head,
Right.
It's just totally improbable. However, the Jews had an event like this every year called Yom Kippur. They would take the two goats, one of them would be released, and one would be sacrificed to, surprise, atone for the sins of all Israel.
Right.
And this is exactly what we have. We have Barabbas, the son of the father, Jesus, the son of the father,
right.
Obviously meaning that these are two sides of one person.
Right.
One of them is being released in the wilderness at the festival once a year. The other one is being sacrificed to atone for the sins of Israel. Now, come on.
Right.
Clearly. I mean, any Jew who read this story would get the point. It's like,
right.
This is not a historical event. This is, they're basically taking the Yom Kippur ideology and saying, Jesus is now replacing the sacrificial lamb. And it has a lot deeper message, too, because Barabbas the reason he's a murderous rebel leader is because these are the sins of Israel.
Right.
And in the atonement ceremony that goes on in the temple, the goat was supposed to have the sins of Israel laid upon the goat, and the scapegoat would be released into the wilderness, and theoretically released to the devil.
Right.
And that's what Barabbas represents. The sins of Israel are their murderous rebellion instead of a peaceful reconciliation with the Roman authorities.
Right.
That was the sins of Israel, and it was released into the wilderness, the mob. And so that was symbolizing what was wrong with Jewish society, and that Jesus was now the guy who was doing it right, and he was being sacrificed, and now he's the final atonement sacrifice. So it's all symbolic. It's all a message. And a Jew would immediately get this. And so it doesn't even read like history at all. I mean, this is exactly what myth does. This is how you formulate myth. This is the point of formulating myth, is to convey a message through a story.
That actually segues me into an excellent question in the chat room. They're actually having a big discussion about this right now. And what is the difference between a religion and a myth? And, Clarkey states that a myth is a religion that nobody believes anymore. and it's funny because when I first read the question, I said, what is the difference between religion and myth? Because they're both the same thing to me, like at first glance. And then I realized, there are people.
Well, a lot of times it's stated as, what's the difference between a cult and a religion?
Religion,
more followers.
Religion is more like you have a set doctrine to follow.
There's
with a myth is really just, isn't it like just a story?
Well, okay, yeah. You can debate it on the level of what contemporary English words mean.
Sure.
Right.
But let's go back to the ancient context. The word mythos meant story, and it usually meant a story with a moral purpose rather than a historical. It wasn't necessarily historical events, but it was something that had an important message.
Right.
And so it was basically assumed that a mythos would be not a true story, except in the sense that the meaning of the story would be the truth conveyed,
right.
not the actual historical events being used.
But the wisdom, exactly.
And so myths were stories like that. A religion would be built out of myths, and it would use myths. I mean, an individual myth is just a piece of a religion. It's not a religion unto itself.
Right.
A religion is when you choose your myths, fit them together, and basically come up with a guide to life based on those myths. And that when you have that whole worldview, that's a religion. And so it's built out of myths.
Yeah, so
all ancient religions, clearly.
But you said your religion is philosophy, so therefore your religion is built out of myths.
Not mine.
Ah. Owned Richard Carrier.
No, we're talking about ancient history, though. Ancient history.
He's being stupid. Don't listen to him.
Things have changed since then, yes.
He's using religion in a vernacular sense.
Okay.
Now we're using
religion in the modern English sense.
Right.
Like I said, you can talk. The word myth in English today has completely different connotations and meanings in application. But in the ancient
like perfection.
Context, it's a different story.
It's almost like perfection having an absolute sense in a vernacular sense, what people use it as and what it actually means.
Well, yeah, that's right. There's lots of words like that.
Here's one of the more ridiculous arguments that I get quite often. It appears to me to be one of the Christians' favorites. Why would the apostles and the early Christians die for a lie?
Yeah.
There we go. I love this one.
Of course, I address this various places on my online writings, but first of all, the immediate response you ask is, give me an example. And as soon as they, name someone, first of all, did they name an eyewitness? If they give you Stephen, Stephen wasn't an eyewitness. And he didn't die Stephen gives the frickin' literally the longest speech in the entire Bible before he dies. This is like his, these are his last dying words. I'm gonna die. Damn it. I'm gonna tell
make
you
sure,
like
make
it
sure,
is.
No, you know,
longest good. Speech. I mean, it goes multiple pages in most Bibles. And yet he never once mentions the resurrection of Jesus as being like a historical event. I mean, almost everything he rants about is about scripture and how the Jews are fucking up the message of God. And right before he dies, he sees Jesus in heaven. In court, of course, so all the other guys in court clearly didn't see it because they had him executed.
Right.
They weren't convinced by that argument. I see Jesus! What? Oh, you lie! So he died for isn't what, it wasn't for a belief in the empty tomb, for example. He doesn't even mention the empty tomb anywhere in there.
Right.
So it's not like, so, and it wasn't even like he would get off like, okay, admit there was no empty tomb and we'll let you go. I mean, no, that wasn't even
right.
the context.
Right.
So that's a completely incorrect example. And then when they start picking people like Peter, well, now you have a source problem. The first reference we have to Peter being dying for his faith comes from a non-canonical gospel. And so if you're going to trust that part of that gospel, why don't you trust the rest of that non-canonical gospel?
Right.
And even then, the context in which Peter was executed had to do with political hostility. It didn't have to do with whether he would recant any particular doctrine.
Right.
So the actual evidence of these eyewitnesses dying for any particular belief is extremely scanty. And there's multiple problems with that. I mean, they were in situations where recanting wouldn't have saved them anyway. Or we don't even know what the actual circumstances of their death were, or even if they didn't, and some of them I'm sure probably just died in old age, or were killed during the Jewish War, you know, by Roman soldiers who had no idea of what their sectarian affiliation was.
Right.
You know.
I would think that question in particular has more to do with not necessarily eyewitnesses, but maybe like those who were persecuted under the Roman Empire.
Mm. But and, of course, all of those examples
then,
come.
They would still have believed it. They would still have believed it without it knowing it was a lie.
Yeah.
So
and it's too late. Yeah, exactly.
And that's always been my biggest point. No one dies for a lie knowing it to be a lie.
Right.
You
right.
know, I, there's no doubt in my mind that these early Christians, that they believed what they, you know, quote unquote were dying for, you know. But, you know, so what? You know, what you, them believing it has no bearing on the truth of the matter.
That's right.
You know,
right, yeah.
You take like, you know, I often use like the Hale Bopp cult, Heaven's Gate.
Yeah,
you know,
classic,
did they die for a lie? Well, you and I know that these people are clearly insane, but they believed what they died for. And I'm actually having a discussion
Adam Ryan.
Forum right
well,
now
with
Adam
Ryan.
Ryan.
You know,
right.
before you go any further, we should let everybody know Adam Ryan is one of the more rational theists that we bumped into. He's a really nice guy.
Smart guy too.
He now is going to help us moderate and run a forum called Killing with Kindness on our message boards, where we're going to break the mold a little bit from the community boards that we're familiar with, and we're going to have like a no insults, you know, very polite theist versus atheist discussion forum. Nothing like our regular atheist versus theist filled with blasphemy and insults and you irrational fool type comments, which I think most theists are. So,
right.
But I myself and of course my partners are going to have to curtail their language in there. I think we might even have to have Rook banned from the forum pretty quickly. No, I was just playing with you, buddy.
I love you, man.
But no, go ahead, Mike. I mean, you know, speak on this, Adam.
But okay. So I gave him like the Heaven's Gate and I also gave him like the Branch Davidians. Okay. And well, he comes back to me. He's like, well, those people didn't create the life they died for. I'm here like, wait. So who was the guy? Applewhite. Was the founder of the Heaven's Gate cult. Well, he created this cult. He created this lie, and then he died for it. He managed to delude himself into believing that this is the truth.
He became so sick that he...
Right. And, you know, you take David Koresh. You know, David
right.
Koresh died along with, you know, all of the, whatever, the
that must,
100 people that...
David Koresh's cult must be true, because who would die for a lie?
Right.
Exactly.
And, you know... Because you know, I guess you could, you know, I use the 9/11 hijackers as an
oh, that's
example
a really
too.
Good
but,
in your face example.
But
they didn't create it, but sure.
But in
right.
Adam's point,
but
Adam
believing it
point,
didn't make it true.
Them believing that their 72 virgins going to meet them in heaven doesn't mean that 72 virgins are going to meet them in heaven.
Right.
You know. But
yeah, well, the whole,
there's another dimension I can add to this. Yeah. Another angle to it is that I mean, it isn't actually true that no one would ever die for a lie. If you believe the lie was more important than your own life.
True.
So, and I have this article in the Journal of Higher Criticism called Whence Christianity, where I analyze what actually I think Christians like Paul thought they were doing as far as what the benefit they thought their belief would have in solving real problems, real social problems facing them at the time. And one of them was trying to find a way for Jews to get along with the Romans. And it was a situation where the Jews, it was a conflict in their ideology. It was cognitive dissonance that they couldn't possibly be conquered by the Romans. It didn't make sense with their entire ideology. So there was two ways to respond to this. One was, eventually God will make us victorious against the Romans. And the other is that it's not about earthly things. We can get good with God in another heavenly kingdom where God will come down and set things straight. And those are the two views. And the one view, of course, leads to militancy, leads to the zealots. It's, okay, we're going to take up arms against the Romans. It doesn't matter how invincible they seem. God will be on our side. He'll kick their ass for us.
Right.
Which, of course, led to constant violence, conflict, the Romans cracking down, life becoming more miserable in Judea. That clearly was not working. So the other solution is to come up with a way to accept Roman authority and at the same time still accept the supremacy of your religion and that your God will set everything right eventually without getting militant, without creating social problems. You could see someone, I could understand someone like Paul, seeing this situation where the Jews are in a bad situation with the Romans. Everything would be better for everyone if they could get along, and that it would actually be good for humanity if they believed a certain belief that would set things right. And so it's possible, I could see someone like Paul knowing that it's all bullshit, but honestly and sincerely believing that it's better that they believe this than that they go on believing this thing that's actually screwing things up for them.
Right.
And that I could see him actually being willing to die heroically for the good of mankind simply because he might even rationalize it as, you know what, my death will finally guarantee that they'll believe this message and that they'll actually start fulfilling my social vision for society and will actually make things better for mankind.
Right.
I mean, I can actually see religious persons thinking that way. And so that to them, it's not a mischievous lie. It's not a lie meant to make money. It's not a lie to gain power or anything. It's a lie that they actually believe is an altruistic lie that's good for the world. And there are people who would be willing to die for that sort
right.
of thing.
And I have another level to add on to this as well. Part of the reason why I don't think Adam Ryan truly understands what we're talking about yet is he's misrepresenting the mythicist position in a way that he's stating that they died for a lie in a sense that he's still assuming the point that Jesus really lived. But if we accept the mythicist position, whereas the early Christians, the early Gnostics, didn't believe in a historical Christ, they saw him as right. a spiritual one, they weren't dying for a lie.
Right.
They
you
were dying for
die,
what?
Yeah. You can die for a spiritual Christ rather than a Christ
right.
in the flesh.
And Paul still converted to something. So yeah. the beliefs that Paul converted to were around for a while yet. So, you know, up until that time period, they wouldn't have really created anything as much as they would have just been following.
Yeah, I mean, technically, Paul would have died for the mythical Christ rather than the historical Christ. The
right.
People start dying for the historical Christ only in the second century, as far as we can tell.
Right.
I think Ignatius is the first recorded instance, unless we count the Christian. Well, yeah, the Christians killed by Pliny the Younger.
Right.
Depending on whether those were Christians that gave him this historicist information, which is complicated by the fact that there, like you've pointed out before, there were esoteric doctrines and there were exoteric doctrines, and the exoteric doctrines were the things you told
other people
who weren't initiates. Even a magistrate who was torturing you, you would tell him the exoteric doctrine, not the esoteric one. The exoteric doctrine might have been the myth represented as a historical claim.
Right.
Whereas the esoteric doctrine might have been, well, that's not the real story. The real story is this myth symbolizes important truths that are necessary for your salvation.
Right. We can't tell you that.
So you could have had a situation where Pliny the Younger is torturing this poor deaconess for her to confess. She tells this whole story about this Jesus being executed by Pontius Pilate, knowing all along that that's actually a lie,
right.
But it's a lie that she needs to tell an outsider because the outsider is not morally worthy to hear the truth.
Right.
And so she was dying actually to preserve the real Christian truth. I mean, that could have happened. And so you could have had a situation where they were mythicists spreading a seemingly historicist doctrine in the same way that Masons will give a different account of things to outsiders, but insiders get the inside knowledge of what the truth is.
Right.
And so that's a possibility. So there's which leaves three possible ways that Pliny's scenario could have transpired. Those deaconess could have been a total mythicist, and that's why he said it was all nonsense. Or she could have, by that point, have been a convinced historicist and not known about the mythicist esoteric doctrine.
Or it
could have been this middle case, like I just described. And we don't know because Pliny doesn't give us enough information.
Right. And even still, like, you know, Adam Ryan says, if the early Christians, including the 12 apostles, I'll stop right there for a second because we have no extra-biblical evidence for the 12 apostles. And even in the Gospels, they can't even agree on the names of the 12 apostles.
Yeah, I mean, there's non-canonical Christian documents like the bogus acts, all the bogus acts and bogus gospels.
But those are still like dated well past.
Oh, certainly, yes. You're talking first century, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
There's nothing.
I mean, there's Paul's references, although he doesn't call them disciples. He only knows of apostles.
Right. And apostles is not the same as disciples.
Yeah, and he includes Apollos and himself in that number. Exactly.
And he himself even admits that he never met Christ in the flesh ever. So,
yeah.
It's just, and then he says, who created Christianity, knew that it was a lie, doesn't it seem a bit illogical to even postulate that all of them, with the exception of one, would gladly lay down their life, for a lie that they all made up? And again, like, I think it's a bit extreme. Well, it is a bit extreme in the context of a historical sense.
Yeah, but if you look at what lie they were dying for, whether it was even a lie at that point,
right.
Because this is too early in Christian history to know.
Right.
Or if recanting would even save them. I mean, if you're in a situation where you're going to be executed
regardless,
why recant? I mean,
exactly.
Why not make your death useful to the sect, you know?
Right. And even still, from this position, from the exoteric point of view, stating that maybe these Christians weren't even part of the Gnostic sect per se, these were Christians who didn't even believe in a historical Jesus yet, why would they even propose to have, have any belief in something that they didn't feel was a lie? Going back to my essay that I'm writing, you still have the possibility that this belief has been around for 100 years before the turn of the first century BCE. So, it's improbable that even if you go back to the first century CE, doesn't necessarily mean that the 12 apostles even existed, let alone died for a lie, even if they had existed in a sense of, them being esoteric leaders. That doesn't necessarily mean they were lying either.
Yeah, it's the whole die for a lie thing that I think it's just, it's not really an accurate representation of what the mythicist is
right.
saying occurred.
And I think it's ironic that actually Gedon was the one who got it right.
Yeah. And
I had to correct him on one point.
Occasionally,
Gedon,
he comes
I
out with
stop
a,
it.
I see
no,
you not.
He comes
I
out
had
with a,
got some stop.
He comes out. He
well,
comes
I'll
out
tell,
with
right,
a
right,
big
right,
old
right.
nugget of truth on occasion.
Oh, hold on.
You can't deny
I'll tell you
that.
What. I'll tell you what. I know what I did. I had to correct him on one point though. He stated at the end that this is Gedon representing the mythicist's case, and I think it's pretty good. I'm really impressed by it. I have to say, really impressed by it. I don't think the mythicist's position is that Christianity was made up or that the earliest apostles were lying, but that they regarded Jesus as having been purely heavenly being. If the Christianity they promulgated rose out of the belief that a heavenly Jesus appeared to people in visions, e.g. Paul, then they would have been dying for a lie. They wouldn't have been dying for a lie at all. They would have been dying for something they generally believed in. At some later stage, this is his problem. Instead of being believed to have died for mythical Jesus, the stories were changed so that they died for historical Jesus.
Exactly.
But at the end, I wouldn't say that they were changed. It almost makes it sound like they were changed purposely.
I don't believe they were.
They
adapted.
Right. It's just whispered down the alley after
right.
a while. And if you do have, as Richard Carey was saying, and that I've said before, especially in parts of my dissertation, you have the esoteric and the exoteric. Now, the exoteric would have been historical time frame. They would have placed it or told somebody, just like,
Right, yeah. And like
some of the early Christians.
As the Gnostics tend to lose influence. Like
right.
You would probably see a more, historical person in the flesh type of Jesus coming.
Right. It just starts to develop that way. So, I mean, he was right, except for that very last part. I think that it's clear that we understand that the transition from the mythist position from being a myth to actually becoming a historical a persona is that it's not a 360 sort of change. It's more of
right.
like a gradual progression of
an evolution.
Certain,
if you will.
Yeah, it is. A certain series of events have to take place in order to have this actually happen. Or, sometimes in the case of some earlier Greek writings, people just, placed, mythical prior characters into a myth, into a historical timestamp.
Right.
Like,
right. We brought that up.
Didn't Homer?
Steve, right?
Homer did that too, didn't he? I'm pretty sure Homer placed mythical characters in a historical timestamp.
Yeah, obviously the Trojan War.
Right.
And that brings back right to my example about Virgil doing the same thing
right.
by just renaming the characters and putting them in Roman
right.
history in a different place. They had no problem doing
it. Well,
that.
And Romulus is another case.
Yeah,
Romulus.
Yes, yes. Plutarch writes entire biographies of Romulus and Theseus, for example, as if these were like actual historical
exactly.
persons,
and,
which is very unlikely that they were ever actual historical. Persons.
So I think the whole mythicist position in a sense is so much more, as you state at the very beginning of the show, is it so much more...
It's more plausible. More probable, I would say.
But this
only becomes clear when you've fully examined the evidence.
Right.
I mean, I have gotten rid of certain prejudices where you're just simply assuming certain passages should be interpreted a certain way, instead of stepping back and asking whether you're even starting with the right presuppositions as to how you should be interpreting passages.
Right. I mean, I have 7 years on me. You have like seven more, more than that on me.
Probably, I don't know, probably like 30 years on me. I have nothing.
You know, you've been studying since you were like a baby. You probably picked up the Bible and were like, eh.
Well, I was reading it as a kid, but I wasn't studying it on this kind of level.
Level, right.
For only like the past 10 years.
And I will admit to being a neophyte and probably a bit biased, but, the arguments that I hear that, you know, the mythicists make, they just seem to be more convincing to me.
Funny as we started out not believing them.
Well, the thing is, you know, even when I first became an atheist, I had no problem at all believing that there was some dude named Yeshua walking around in Judea and preaching. And,
me too.
You know, you find more about it, and you know, like, yeah, there's really not a lot of good reasons to think that.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's like Lao Tzu, I'm pretty sure the consensus is that most people believe that he didn't exist either. It's
very difficult to even know. That's another example, however, where the source situation is miserable. We don't have the kind of documents we would need to resolve that question.
But
of course, someone had to have written it.
Right, and even still, you know, you have people claiming that Lao Tzu actually did write the Te Ching. So
within about 500 years, 400 years of it, yeah.
Right. So I mean, it's very. I mean, here's at least something. You know, even if we were to, you know, have a reasonable assumption that he did exist, here's something at least penned in the name of this person.
Yeah.
But Jesus, like you said earlier, doesn't even have that. So, this hurts the case. I gotta tell you, I'm really looking forward to reading your paper. I'm like, I'm dying. I'm so
I can't get enough of this stuff.
Like I said, though, it'll be a while because I want my PhD in place before I start engaging in this professional level.
I don't see any. I don't think any issue with that at all. I think that if you're going to make a case that's something that's this important, you should have all ends covered. You know, truly. And you're the person to do it, you know, honestly.
Yeah, apparently. I've positioned myself to have the right field knowledge and degrees and everything. We'll see.
Well, seems like that wraps up another edition of the Rational Response Squad. Hope that you enjoyed today's episode and that you do look to back up some of what you heard in this episode by doing your own research.
Yes, always do your own research.
Leading us out of here today is a friend of ours, Uncle Scams, with his song Jesus Never Existed. Until next time, folks.
Stay rational.
Stay rational.
Stay rational.
Lies of the devil. When Jesus supposedly rose and sold to the funeral body, does no other historical reform record of this mythological distorted story? Oh, glory! Surely someone would have noticed during the resurrection that the earth shook with black skies, and that some questions like why didn't the man slip everyone's minds and only reach of your feet when he healed the blind? And why didn't they learn to write it all down? And everybody else who saw him walk through the towns remained silent. He single-handedly fed thousands of people with a few loaves of bread, but none of them wrote about it. They ignored it instead. If Jesus rose from the dead and did all the shit that the Bible has said, someone should have noticed and let more than one loaf of bread. Jesus never existed. The evidence is missing, so listen up, all you motherfucking Christians. And if I'm wrong, I'll take it back. I'm just asking the questions nobody likes to ask. The archaeological evidence presents for Jesus is illogical to believe in. Cause Jesus and James as household names are more than common. And the tablet they found was a common denominator that leads a prophet. So get off it, it's not substantial to claim he was a real man, especially more than a man. You just can't rely, no matter how hard you try. If this were a trial, the evidence wouldn't stand. And as for the Bible as a source, it's not reliable. Cause Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were not authors. The titles given to the gospel way after they were written and sold. The actual authors remain unknown, but who bothers to show that this would amount? That the gospels are unreliable eyewitness accounts.
Lies of the devil.
Jesus never existed, the evidence is missing. So listen up, all you motherfucking Christians. As if I'm wrong, I'll take it back. I'm just asking the questions nobody likes to ask. Could there be forgery committed in early Christian history? Let's see, Eusebius openly confessed to excluding things that might bring Christianity negativity. And he was a main piece of this religion developing. A trustworthy, I must confess, that he most likely forged writings into Josephus' article that he was a Pharisee who would never believe in Jesus' divinity. But remarkably and suspiciously, Joseph is his writing contain things about Jesus that he never would have said. Jesus isn't just dead, he never existed.
Lies of the devil.
Jesus never existed, the evidence is missing, so listen up all you motherfucking Christians. And if I'm wrong, I'll take it back, I'm just asking the questions nobody likes to ask. Saying Jesus was a myth might be jumping to conclusions, but if he was the son of God, why is there any confusion? I find it odd that your God did such a bad job, that historical proof is lost, it cannot explain away why so many different faiths survive today, and there's so much discrepancy between doctrines of Christianity. They can't possibly be altering correctly, so which is to believe? Are you sure? Well, you're down on your knees that your translation is pure, and don't many passages seem unneeded and obscure, with intentional to make it seem unconventional? Which texts are sacred and which are dispensable? Is it more sensible that one religion out of millions are sustained and maintained by civilians is correct and the rest are insane? Or is it more easily explained that all gods are products of human brains? The claims of knowledge of the supernatural is slightly insane given the actual facts and lacks of God's actions over the course of 2,000 years or more. So here's the waiting for God to quit taking this time. It's a legend in the making in everybody's mind.
Lies of the devil. Take that, devil. Lies of the devil. Take that, devil. Lies of the devil.
Jesus never existed, the evidence is missing, so listen up all you motherfucking Christians. And if I'm wrong, I'll take it back, I'm just asking the questions nobody likes to ask. In fact, if you do, suddenly a bunch of peaceful people wanna beat your ass and comfort you, so meet me out back up to the show. We can talk about the shit nobody likes to know, like how Jesus never existed, the evidence is missing, so listen up all you motherfucking Christians. And if I'm wrong, I'll take it back, I'm just asking the questions nobody likes to ask.
Lies of the devil.